G7, number 8A.
We go on to the next chapter, to the 12th chapter, Christian Science Practice. And my epitome for this chapter is re-establishing the normality of mortal mind. Perhaps you think that's a funny epitome. And so I have to say a few words about it. First of all, when I said my epitome for the chapter, I naturally meant in regard to our subject of the self-evolution of science, not in regard to the whole chapter as such. That I have presented in the structure book of the Christian Science textbook. So these epitomes only are referring always to our special subject. Don't forget that. So this is not an epitome for the chapter itself, but for those indications that we find in the chapter, which are giving us the groundwork, the basis for the advancement of the idea of understanding Christian Science. If I say that it is re-establishing the normality of mortal mind, that is practice, then you may feel that is quite queer, but it's what Mrs. Eddy says. Mrs. Eddy doesn't say that Christian Science practice, or say healing, physical healing, that is a divine status. But if we would heal a person spiritually, completely, that patient would ascend. It would have no more any corporeality. It would be spiritual, that's man. And the true man that we are going to demonstrate and want to demonstrate in our life is that man which is not corporeal, which is not the mortal, but which is an idea of God, and that naturally is spiritual and no more corporeal. But a healing is corporeal. It needs spiritual ideas to heal those bodies. Can you see again what we saw in the 10th chapter, that we have to go back to the spiritual cause of those lower things which give impulse to inquiry? So we don't heal with mortal mind, we don't heal with matter, we heal with spiritual ideas. They are the cause of those lower things which give impulse to inquiry. The inquiry is, what on earth is sickness? Well, sickness is not a reality. It can always be brought back to mortal mind. When mortal mind gets out of balance, we feel sickness. We feel very well in our body, in our matter, in our five physical senses. We feel very well if that mortal mind is normal. If we would say we want to have the normality of spirit, that would be wonderful, but we would not be here. We would be in the spiritual realm of reality. But somehow we wouldn't like it. We like to stay here. And like to stay here as long as possible. Some of them. Jesus didn't. Jesus didn't have that aim. He didn't want to show that he has an eternal mortal life. So Mrs. Eddy says, what is healing? And I read from the chapter. She says that it is the return to that standard which mortal mind has decided upon as essential for health. Can you see? what we call physical health, when we feel really healthy, really fit and strong and nothing ails us, that is the standard that mortal mind has put up. That's not the standard of divine mind. So real healing, towards which our whole life is directed to, is really to get rid of the mortal sense of body, of the corporeal sense of body. Really to feel that the subject said before, that we know ourselves spiritually and scientifically. That would be the real man. That would be spiritual health. But healing is bringing back the normality of mortal mind. So we shouldn't really put too much stress on healing, because it's only correcting something that is anyway not divine. A healthy body is not a divine proposition. A healthy body is body, and body is corporeal, and is material, and is personal, and is biological, and so on. So that is not the standard of man. So can you understand why I say that it is re-establishing the normality of mortal mind? When mortal mind says, yes, my heart is good, my pulse is all right, and my digestion is all right, and my breathing is all right, and my blood pressure is all right, and my bones work well, my knees work well, and I walk well, and so on, all those mortal organs are well, then I say, I'm healthy. But that's no proof of spirituality. There are many people that never get sick. They don't know anything about spiritual values. Just sometimes think of those healthy people that are strong, say, farmers and so on. They are strong all their lives. They say, I've never had to go and see a doctor. Are they very good Christian scientists? Not at all. They are just normal mortal mind people, huh? Yes. So this is a function here that is shown. This is what Mrs. Eddy called, when I read from Unity of Good, what she called the science of physical harmony. It's not the science of spiritual harmony. So as in the preceding chapter she has shown the line of development, let's do that quickly. See, in the ninth chapter she said that, all right, that chaos must be turned into order. Turning it into order, she said that is something that goes on quietly from a boundless basis, always rising higher and higher. How? The 10th chapter said, yes, I tell you the how. I tell you the how is not that you have a material evolution going on and going higher and higher, but that you have a spiritual cause, a spiritual evolution, that takes away the limitation of mortal mind, of matter. Then you have one spiritual cause for even the material evolution. Then the next chapter shows that evolution does not go on quickly. It takes time. It takes a step-by-step evolution. Now, so the 11th chapter shows that we must be patient with ourselves, that the evolution goes on step by step. What is the first step? The first step is practice. Charles, it is bringing back the normality of mortal mind. It is showing to bring forth the normality of spirit. The oneness of spirit, the uniqueness of spirit, the onlyness of spirit. That is not the question here. That is left to the further chapters. So we come to the next block, to the science chapters. And the science chapters now bring really the result, the effect or the result of the development of science. How? We have first, under that fourth block, teaching Christian science. And there, my epitome is the receptivity for spiritual unfoldment of understanding. That's a great point in it, that we ourselves are receptive for the unfoldment of the understanding. Up to this point, we are receptive and very receptive for the normality of mortal mind, for healing, for having a harmonious material mortal life. Now comes the last four chapters, which really brings us into the spiritual realm, into the science of spiritual harmony against the science of physical harmony. And in order to enter into that realm, we must be aware that we have the receptivity not only for something good, that we had right from the beginning, that we were receptive for God, that we are receptive for the, all that is good in life. But now it's a receptivity for the understanding of science. That's something different. That's something which we have perhaps not cultured so much as culturing, so to say, a good mortal human life. Yes. What is it that characterizes this chapter mostly? I think it is just showing that what the chapter tells us at the end of the chapter, namely under the subtone of love and as truth and love as love, namely mental anatomy is a whole paragraph, and then comes scientific obstetrics. These two paragraphs should really be considered together because they supplement each other, they complement each other. First of all, before we have scientific obstetric, we really should have this mental anatomy, which she describes, and which shows that we first have to look into ourselves and see what is actually our motive, what is actually that which is foremost in our mind. Is it something spiritual or something material? And so she gives that sense of mental anatomy, which I have also explained in a little pamphlet called The Psychology of Spirit, and that treats with this paragraph on mental anatomy, which says, search first yourself. What is your motive? What do you really drive at? What is your aim? What is foremost in your consciousness? And it's interesting to see that she brings in the sense of love in three different degrees. That there must be love with a small l, namely that our motive must be unselfish. That's a love on the lower level. No love for self is unselfishness. So that we study Christian science out of an unselfish motive. That's very seldom that we study truth for truth's sake. Usually we study it because something ails us, because some disharmony is reigning in our life, and we want to get rid of. It's not agreeable. We want to get rid of it, and therefore we say, where is the remedy? Well, the remedy is in the textbook, and we study Christian Science in order to get rid of something that has to do with our own self. That's not the true motive for a science. Now we come to that is unselfed, that is free from a self, that has not the selfish ambition or the selfish aim, but is absolutely unselfish. Do we really love science for science's sake? That's the problem. That's the question. That's one kind of love that must be within us. Then she speaks about philanthropy. That's the love for mankind. Do we really study that science because we want to save mankind, not me, or not my husband, or my children? Usually the range of the interest in Christian Science is about the family. Perhaps some relatives may be included, but the rest of the world can go pot. That doesn't matter. That's not philanthropy. It must be a love that we feel. We study Christian Science for the sake of that science, in order that the whole world will benefit of it, that it is a beneficiary activity for the whole world, no matter if the world knows it and feels it or not. That is, sorry, that's not quite right what I said. No matter if the world knows it, but it feels it. It doesn't feel that we have been entertaining a higher concept of being. It may not know that, but it feels the beneficial effect of our work. And as a third and highest, she had spiritual love. So these three are necessary within us. Do we have that love for science for the sake of unselfishness, philanthropy, and spiritual love? That must be the motive power within us, and without that, our mentality, our mental anatomy is found out to be insufficient, not transparent for the science. Only then, when that is cleared out, then we have the paragraph on scientific obstetrics, then, only then, we are ready for the new idea to be born. Then comes the birth of the idea. It's not the birth of a child or a baby, it's what she calls a divine idea. It's the birth of the idea. Yeah, she says, she talks about the birth of the new child or divine idea. She doesn't say of a divine idea. So you could apply it also to a divine idea, but the purpose of that chapter and the paragraph is really the birth of the divine idea, that idea of science. That has to be born. That is the thing that we want to see to come to the forefront, so that we have a higher level of consciousness in science. Yes, that is the very first attitude that we find in the science block, that there must be a pure receptivity within ourselves that says, what I want is science, but not something selfish, something for me, something for my family, something for my business. And all the rest of the world is something else, that the world has to look after itself, and that doesn't concern me. We cannot have a limited sense, a limited mind with which to work. Our mind must be always the divine mind, and that divine mind is the divine mind for the whole world. Then we go and come to the next chapter, recapitulation, where this receptivity is asked to be of a scientific nature. That's recapitulation. It's scientific metaphysics that is to be asked for. You know, in the introduction to the chapter, Mrs. Eddy writes that absolute Christian science pervades its statement. So it's absolute Christian science that pervades its statement to elucidate scientific metaphysics. It uses very seldom. And this is the most important one she uses. I think she only uses it twice in her textbook, scientific metaphysics. But here she gives a good definition of it for the purpose of the whole chapter, namely to elucidate scientific metaphysics. So we can see something very interesting. We can see that the first chapter of this block, namely teaching Christian science, is teaching us that we have to be receptive for science. That without this receptiveness, nothing will happen. Receptive for science. She goes a step further to recapitulation and shows us first scientific metaphysics, not yet science itself. So she gives the system of Christian science. Those 24 answers questions and answers are presenting a system. They are not just put out there at random, just asking questions, but they are questions that are in the deep structure, are constituting a system. That's the point. So in Christian science, you can ask hundreds and hundreds of questions. That's what we always experience, that the people always come, they meet you on the road, they meet you at the dining table, and they say, I have a question. I have a question. All what I do during the week next to teaching Christian science is answering questions. Well, I try to be kind, but I have a hell of a time to try to be kind. Because if one knows science, one has all the answers. There are no questions. It just shows that one is not perhaps able to bring back all the hundreds and thousands of questions that are coming up in one's life, that one cannot reduce them to a system. If we can reduce them to a system, and it's a simple system, it's only 24 questions and answers, that's not very much. In other disciplines, you have to learn much more than 24 things. Actually, later on you come only to 15 root notions. It's even simpler than that. If you know those, there is no room for questions. So try, if you can, try out the system. And we can see that we are still way back in the atomistic thinking. That's the trouble. That's why the whole Christian science movement goes down. That's why Christian science as such goes right down the drain. Because it has stayed there where we were 120 years ago, asking atomistic questions. Each question is a question by itself, nicely isolated from the whole system, so that each question has an answer adapted to that question, but it's not science. It's atomistic thinking. And this is what is seems to be so difficult, namely to be simple. Instead of having thousands and thousands of questions, we would only have a few fundamentals. Science is that wonder of wonders that takes the infinite and reduces it down to some simple categories. and to some simple root notions of reality. That's the wonder of wonders. That's why we do that with arithmetic. That's why when you leave school, you don't need your teacher, your math teacher, to be always with you to ask him, how do I calculate? How would you calculate 25 times 25? I haven't done that before, so how do I do it? You wouldn't ask the teacher. You know how to do it. This is what is under discussion here in this chapter, that it is reducing the infinite to 24 question answers, quite rightly showing it that it is very simply built up. Namely, there are 24 questions. Half of it, 12 of it, are on the level of absolute Christian Science. The other half is on the level of Christian Science. So you only have really 12 questions. Those 12 questions are always built up in the same way, namely 3 times 4 questions for every side of the holy city. So if we know the holy city as a four-sided city, we really have already reduced these questions to groups of 3, and those 3 are the 3 sides of the holy city that are reflected in it. So it's only a question of really categorizing your consciousness. To categorize your consciousness, that's the beginning of science. So you can see now we begin to get to the science of Christian Science by seeing the system of Christian Science. The Word as the Word as the Christ, the Word as Christianity. Going to the Christ in absolute Christian Science and in Christian Science. Then to the Christ, Christ as the Christ as the Christianity, Christ as the Word, and so on. As you know it from the structure book, I don't have to explain it. What I want to explain is that we see that we get rid of the atomistic thinking. This is old. This is 120 years old. We are grown out of that. All the other science have grown out of that. They all have systematized their science, and have systematized it and have categorized their science. Why don't we do it? It seems so difficult for some students to think in categories instead of in isolated truths. Why do you think in categories, in isolated truths, when you can do something which is much higher than that and think in categories? In the category of the world order, for instance, in the category of the Christ order. Well, the Christ order gives the answer to every question. The Christ is the divine message from God to man. Why should that message come from Max to the student? I don't see why. I don't see why. Why do you go to a teacher, to a Max, and ask him a question when the whole textbook tells God gives you the answer? Yeah? Is that not so? Doesn't the textbook tell that? The textbook never says, go to the teacher and ask him. Never. Not once. Why are we not obedient to the textbook? That's always my great, great question mark. Why not stay with the textbook? Why always deviate from the textbook? The textbook says the Christ is the divine message from God to man. It doesn't say the Christ is the message from your teacher to the student. It doesn't say that. It says, where do we find an answer? The answer alone, God knows all. Max doesn't know all. He only knows a little bit. See?